Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
You can't separate the Navy from the world's oceans. Almost since its founding, the Navy has maintained expertise in ocean science to help it perform its mission. Now it's launching a task force to improve its chops in ocean science. Joining me with more, Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, the Navy's chief oceanographer and commander of the Naval Meteorological and Oceanography Command. Admiral Gallaudet, great to have you on.
Great to be with you.
First of all, tell us what this task force will do, who is on it, and what is its purpose?
Sure. The whole purpose of this task force is to advance ocean science within the U.S. and help the and increase the Navy's capabilities to exploit that information. The task force is comprised of the Navy flag leadership in the Pentagon, as well as Fleet Forces Command, PAC Fleet, and the Office of Naval Research. But we include a wide array of partners in the academic community, in the private sector, and in other areas, like, for example, some NGOs that are all advocating for advanced ocean science.
Ocean science sounds like a pretty broad field. In terms of ocean science and naval operations, what is the connection there?
Well, sure. Understanding the ocean better allows us to operate both safely and more effectively, because the physical environment affects all aspects of naval operations, including our ability to conduct surveillance and reconnaissance, to actually use our weapons and our various sensors, and to communicate and navigate effectively. Think about, a sea state. A sea state and high seas can limit all sorts of operations, including an aircraft carrier. I've been on board as an officer of the deck of an aircraft carrier, and when you have a very long period swell on the quarter, you're not going to be able to conduct flight ops if that swell's over eight feet or so, because even a carrier can roll like a destroyer in different sea conditions.
Where does weather end and surface conditions end and ocean science begins?
They're very much linked because the atmosphere drives ocean circulation and sea state. So it's the currents that affect submarine operations, and it's the sea state that affects surface operations. So the atmosphere and the ocean are tightly coupled. And so really, when we talk about ocean science in general, it's the environmental system that the Navy has to operate in, from the seabed to the actually out to space. And so we're working to advance our understanding of that. The emphasis is on the ocean itself, because we believe that our preeminent advantage against our competitors is undersea, with our undersea warfare capabilities, and that is the main focus of this task force, to ensure we preserve that competitive advantage.
So if a submarine is below the waves, then there are also currents. And what about temperature, too? Does that affect things?
Absolutely. Temperature affects sound speed and the propagation path of sound waves. So knowing that thermal structure of the ocean allows our submarine to basically see our adversaries without being seen. And that's a critical capability that naval oceanography provides.
Knowledge of the science then can help the design of instrumentation that can tell a commander of a vessel what's going on ahead.
Absolutely. That's correct. We're working to advance both the instrumentation to observe and sense ocean conditions, but also the supercomputer-powered models that predict future ocean conditions. That's equally important. And then there's a third part of it in addition, and that's these decision aids or tools. You could think of big data analytics as another term to describe the software and algorithms that predict the impact of ocean conditions on weapons, sensors, and platforms.
So how things travel from point A to point B under the water are affected by all of this?
Absolutely. And our goal is to be able to predict those impacts to a higher fidelity, more accurately, and at longer lead times.
We're speaking with Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet, the Navy's chief oceanographer and commander of the Naval Meteorological and Oceanography Command. And you've noted that very little of the ocean, much as we've been plying it for all these centuries, is actually mapped. Tell us more about some of those statistics.
Well, that's correct, Tom. You know, that we have mapped the surface of the moon and Mars, mind you, to a higher fidelity than we have our own ocean floor. For example, we've only explored 5% of the world's ocean's volume, and we've only mapped to modern standards 20% of the ocean's seafloor. And this is all at a time where 100% of the world's oceans are changing due to climate change, especially in the Arctic, And so those all are driving the Navy's desire to understand the ocean better, because after all, it's our operating environment, and we need to know it to be more effective.
Do you sense that other navies like Russia, for example, the countries that have substantial navies, are also studying these same things? And so there's a tactical purpose here too, correct?
They are. Our competitors see how good we are at understanding the ocean and predicting it, and they're trying to catch up. And that really is the whole purpose of this task force, to ensure we maintain our lead and advantage in this area.
What will the task force do specifically?
Our specific task is going to be to write out a 5-year plan or roadmap to advance our capabilities in a number of areas. We talked about a few. It's sensing and observations. It's modeling and prediction. The third is these decision aids. Another piece is our technical workforce. So this is people within academia that are our instructors. It is engineers and oceanographers and technicians at our warfare centers, and it includes people in our workforce at the Naval Oceanographic Office, all of which we want to increase the number of people, their skills, and our ability to train and maintain them in the force.
Does each ship or each, say, group have someone aboard that knows oceanography?
Yes, we have on the big decks. We have all big decks have oceanographers assigned to them for the purpose of understanding and predicting the environment. And then as needed for high-value operations, we'll send out teams of sailors along different warfare lines. So we have teams that do ASW support, teams that do strike group support, teams that do mine warfare and naval special warfare support. So really the whole Navy has different types of teams that deploy for specialized functions to predict again and assess the impact of the ocean or the atmosphere on naval operations.
Sounds like the task force will, in addition to looking at the ocean itself, talk about artificial intelligence, algorithms for analyzing data, and maybe even graphics.
That's a big part of it, absolutely. And I think naval oceanography is a leader in the man-machine teaming, if you will. Our job is big data, and so it's taking in disparate data types, whether it be from underwater drones, satellites, buoys, and then feeding that into these operational models to predict the environment and then assess impacts on the fleet. And so a lot of those, though, it'll take a skilled forecaster in the loop because not always. The analogy would be weather models. You know, you've seen probably the spaghetti plot of various model tracks, and we're still not at a point where we can totally automate the best track. It'll take a skilled forecaster in the loop who knows each model's tendency for any given region of the world and can pick that best track to keep the fleet safe.
But as the Navy moves toward more autonomous vehicles, especially underwater autonomous ones, or I guess surface too, this will come into play. But it sounds as if even with autonomy, you still need someone checking in on a device from time to time.
Well, sure. Autonomy is already greatly increasing our ability to understand the ocean. I have a fleet of nearly 200 underwater drones, different types of vehicles, from gliders to large AUV, autonomous underwater vehicles, and that is allowing us to do more with less and fewer people. But it's funny, you know, there really is no unmanned. You know, my fleet of vehicles still requires servicing and deployment and recovery. And so there is going to be a huge part of people in the loop.
There are other federal agencies that look at the ocean. NASA studies extensively from space and, of course, National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Is there collaboration among them with the Navy?
Oh, big time. We've had longstanding partnerships with NASA and NOAA, and we will continue to do that. This task force is a opportunity to strengthen and expand those partnerships.
And what about the issues of pollution, and there's big blobs of plastic I've read about in the ocean? Do those all affect or potentially affect naval operations?
I think the impact of those aspects of the ocean and ocean conservation are fairly limited on naval operations. But we want to use our role as an expert in ocean science and oceanography as a kind of bully pulpit to advocate for the larger U.S. ocean science enterprise. And so certainly from the ocean conservation standpoint, though I will not be targeting those areas for specific, you know, advancement for the Navy, I will advocate for the larger national issues so that, conserving our oceans is important to our public, and we want to champion that cause.
And from your perch at your command, do you hear from vessel commanders, captains, that say, gosh, if I could only know this 50 miles ahead or across the ocean, I could operate better in some manner? Do you get that type of feedback?
Oh, absolutely. There is great demand to increase the lead time and the accuracy of our forecast. I'd say we do very well. When I first joined the Navy 30 years ago, we would be lucky to have a forecast for 24 hours that actually panned out. You know, now people can plan their weekend on the Monday morning workday and be pretty reliable. It's either going to be sunny and you can go to a ball game or not. And the same goes for our ocean forecast and weather forecast used by the Navy. We're good, but we can do better. And as you said, we're not quite there with an accurate 2-week forecast or 3-month forecast, but we have plans to get better through building better supercomputers and with the Office of Naval Research, advancing the science that underpins our models.
Rear Admiral Tim Gallaudet is the Navy's Chief Oceanographer and Commander of the Naval Meteorological and Oceanography Command. Thanks so much for joining me.
It was great to be with you, Tom. Thanks.
We'll have a link to more information and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Profile America, Monday, April 24th. Early America certainly was a simpler society than that which we have today, but some of today's familiar institutions were part of the national experience over 220 years ago. On this date in 1795, the city of Baltimore set up a permanent elected Board of Health, successor to the nation's first such appointed agency. The first board was created by Maryland's governor to cope with yellow fever epidemics beginning in 1792. Still, Baltimore was affected in 1794, and hundreds died as a result. Across the country, there are 1.25 million people employed in state and local government hospitals and in health services. Over 700,000 are working at the local level. You can find more facts about America's people, places, and economy from the American Community Survey at census.gov.
Join Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller for Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2. Hear from your agency's top tech leaders on how they're using technology to change the way you meet your agency's mission. Ask the CIO is a must-listen for anyone who needs to know federal technology policy, implementation, and planning. Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask CIO.
A violent gang member is the newest addition to the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. An up to $100,000 reward is available for information leading directly to the arrest of Walter Giovanni Gomez. Leadership from the MS-13 gang in Plainfield, New Jersey, ordered Gomez to kill his friend for associating with a rival gang. Gomez and another gang member attacked his friend after a night of drinking in May of 2011. Case agent Daniel Bruner.
They hit him on the head with a baseball bat, sliced his throat, and stabbed him on his back 17 times.
When police tried to arrest Gomez,
he jumped out the second floor window of his home and escaped into the city of Plainfield.
The next day, gang members drove Gomez from New Jersey to Maryland to hide out with MS-13 members there. Gomez, also known as Cholo, is a native of Honduras. Report tips to 1-800-CALL-FBI or contact your nearest American embassy or consulate. With Wanted by the FBI, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
The Army Reserve has taken on a much more important strategic role in the last couple of decades. Now about 200,000 strong, it's about to celebrate another birthday. Participating in those celebrations will be Army Sergeant First Class Joshua Mahler. He's also the Army's non-commissioned officer of the year. And he joins me now. Sergeant Mahler, great to have you on.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
What are the challenges these days of living the dual life of Sergeant First Class in the Reserves and also having a regular career outside of all that?
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. Today, you know, Army Reserve soldiers have to be so multifaceted because not only is our world getting more complex, but, you know, our military challenges are too. And you're absolutely right. I have to, on Monday through Friday, you know, I'm in a suit and tie and all that at my insurance job. And then on the weekends, you know, I'm back in camouflage and making sure that we're maintaining a ready force for the Army Reserve. It's an interesting challenge, but for those that are looking for something that's, you know, a little bit outside the norm, but exciting, and also called to serve, it's a fantastic opportunity, sir.
I guess it's good incentive to avoid the donuts that someone might bring in one morning, too.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, you definitely need to be fit in the military. That's never changed.
And when the Army Reserves does celebrate the, I guess, 109th anniversary, what happens? How do you celebrate a thing like that?
Oh, sir, we've got tons of things going on this week, actually, leading up into the birthday on the 23rd. We're going to be having cake cuttings all around the Army Reserve. Plenty of units are going to be turning out and doing things on social media as well as traditional media. And we're going to have ourselves, particularly my cohorts and I, are going to have a great time in New York City this week, going around with West Point and at a Mets game. And we're going to culminate with a TV interview. It's going to be fantastic stuff, sir.
And returning to the fact that you are the Reserve Officer of the Year, non-commissioned, what's involved in achieving that?
You know, sir, for the last year, I actually had to commit to compete in what's called Best Warrior competitions. Think of it kind of like a decathlon for soldiers. For a week at a time, at each level, starting all the way down at battalion level, which is only a collection of about 200 soldiers, we go through all kinds of things from land navigation, which is with a map and a compass in the middle of the woods looking for tiny little points, to physical fitness tests and board appearances, general military knowledge, road marching, which is essentially the military's version of putting a heavy backpack on your back and walking for 12 miles faster than anybody else, obstacle courses, all kinds of stuff, and as well as obviously marksmanship as well. We get out on all the ranges, shoot all the weapons, and whoever does it best at the end of the week, whoever's standing tallest, is the one that wins. And I had to do that 5 times over the course of the last year at every level of competition, and came out on top last October.
So you can probably also collect a few mugs in the neighborhood 5Ks, too, while you're at it.
Sure did, sir. Absolutely. Yeah, I did a lot of train-up in between those competitions. A lot of miles on my feet, lots of rounds downrange, lots of shooting, and lots of going up and down and climbing ropes.
Now, your family has a big, wide history of military service.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, sir. 3 out of my 4 grandfathers served, 2 of them all the way through retirement. My sister and brother-in-law both served in the military. My other brother-in-law that my wife is not married to, he's currently serving as a lieutenant in the Navy. So we've got a very, very proud history, absolutely.
And one of the issues you read about all the time, I read about it all the time, is that there is this divide or growing divide between the general public and the military. And also one of the reasons is that military service is becoming more and more family-centered, as you describe. How do we bridge that from your standpoint?
You know, I think it really comes, especially the Army Reserve is well positioned to bridge that gap, as you describe it. Because, you know, we are citizens in the community, like I said, Monday through Friday. We're regular folks, regular jobs, you know, in the community contributing to the greater good of local and regional communities. And that's, I think, really where it starts. Your Army Reserve soldiers, I mean, they're doctors, lawyers, scientists, technical professionals, and all those sorts of things. And then, you know, on the weekend, they happen to serve in the reserve as well. So if there's a divide between the military and the general public, that's really where the conversation needs to start, and it can take away a little bit of the mystery, I think, is really what it comes down to. Whenever there's misunderstanding or a divide, it's usually just the fact that the conversation needs to happen, and that's where it should start.
We're speaking with Army Sergeant First Class Joshua Mahler, who is the Army's non-commissioned officer of the year. He's now serving in the reserves. And review the drill instructor history that you had. I guess you were out of the regular Army by that point.
Yeah, I had I'd done 10 years active service and then transitioned into the reserve in 2010 and actually did it specifically to become a drill sergeant. I volunteered for that, and the reserve gave me a great opportunity to do that, to continue to serve as well as transition into a civilian life as well. So I graduated drill sergeant school in 2011 out of Fort Jackson, South Carolina, and immediately every summer after that was back in Fort Benning, Georgia, Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, pushing brand new trainees through basic combat training in the Army to become active duty soldiers, Army reservists, and National Guard soldiers.
What's it like to have the confidence knowing that even though the recruits may not know they can get through it, you know they can get through it?
You know, that is really that's the epitome of why you put NCOs, non-commissioned officers, in basic training leading soldiers, because we've been there. Well, you know, I remember being that young soldier, being that young recruit, learning the Army for the first time, not sure whether or not you could do it, but having that old, wizened, maybe not so old, but that wizened, experienced soldier with the big hat showing you how it's done first and then telling you to do it immediately after that, you really realize that being shown the right way is a huge component of being able to do that. And it works every single time. The drill sergeant has been there throughout the Army's history, the Army Reserve obviously as well, and it's the way to go.
And you did complete 3 tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. Not everyone came back from those multiple tours of duties equally. Some came back broken, maybe in spirit or in body in some ways. And so there's the issue of the rest of society relating to those people as they reintegrate. What's your best advice for the rest of us?
You know, when it comes to the soldiers that come back that are, have seen combat and those sorts of things, you just caring and compassion is number one. You know, they're still Americans. They've seen some stuff and they've been out there, but what you want to do is realize that they're not that different. They're just a little bit more experienced. We all go through changes in life, and if we can think back to our own experiences, going through interesting experiences, that we become a little bit different as well. So I think that compassion, being able to relate that way, is the best way to go about that.
And as the anniversary of the Army Reserve comes up, what about people on the outside that may want to stop by and show support? That doable?
Yeah, absolutely. If you see a soldier on the road, or on the street, if you see someone at your local reserve center, obviously don't jump any security barriers or anything like that, but just stop them on the street. And people have been fantastic at that over the last 15 years and beyond. The average American citizen just stop it. I've seen it in my personal experience. People just stop at soldiers on the road or service personnel in general. And just saying thank you for your service, happy 109th birthday to the Army Reserve. That's a fantastic way to participate, absolutely.
Sergeant First Class Joshua Mahler is the Army's Non-Commissioned Officer of the Year. Thanks so much for joining me.
Absolutely. Thank you, sir.
Find more information and a link to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.
Monday and Wednesday afternoons at 1, Aileen Black and Gigi Shum host Women of Washington. Hear from the role models influencing the next generation of female executives in both the public and private sectors. Learn why career ladders sometimes look like a jungle gym and how to climb it. Women of Washington, Monday and Wednesday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federal.